from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. From driverless cars to 3D printing, inventions that we once only imagined are now reality. MIT experts Andrew McAfee and Eric Brynjolfsson have dubbed this era of growing automation and digitalization the second machine age. And they'll join us to talk about what these vast and ongoing technological changes mean for our social and economic futures. That's next up on Forum, right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. And get ready for what Alvin Toffler called future shock. Digital technology is transforming economies and our lives. Pocket smartphones equivalent to supercomputers of just a generation ago. Jeopardy-winning computers, driverless automobiles, flexible factory robots. The future, as Andy Grove once said, is already here. And according to authors Andrew McAfee and Eric Brynjolfsson of MIT, a new machine age has begun, an entirely new paradigm shift from the first machine age, which began in the late 18th century with the invention of the steam engine. These two authors, who Brynjolfsson directs the Center for Digital Business at MIT and Andrew McAfee is the center's principal research scientist, authored a book called Enterprise 2.0, that is Andrew McAfee did, and they co-authored a book called Race Against the Machine. Their most recent book, which is still talking about racing maybe with the machine, is called The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. And they both join us, and we welcome you to the program. Good morning, Eric. Good morning, Andrew.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Thanks, Michael.
Good to have you here. Well, we're going to be presumably accomplishing more human tasks through all of these changes that you have outlined in your book. Better diagnosing than doctors do, economies with data applications transforming retail. I mean, there's just a whole potpourri of things here. I want to get into them all, but I told you, I get a little scared by this because I remember talking to Jeremy Rifkin and he said, you know, all the jobs are going to be eliminated by the internet. Well, he was wrong. I mean, it was too hyperbolic. But you know, I see a lot of labor affected by this and a lot of jobs obviously are going to be eliminated in this new machine age that you're talking about. Already being eliminated.
Absolutely. And the economic statistics these days, when you look at the ones related to employment growth and wage growth, there are some real challenges out there. One of the main reasons we wrote this book was to bring attention to those challenges and to highlight the role that technology is playing. There's a lot of awareness in the effects of the recession and the slow recovery, and there's a lot of awareness about the effects of globalization on work. We think that technology has been an underappreciated force driving a lot of the things that we see. It's a big force, and it's only going to get bigger.
And when you talk about the second machine age, Andrew, you're talking really about the first machine age being physical limitations overcome. Now we're talking about essentially mental cognitive limitations being overcome.
Yeah, exactly. The analogy that we're drawing is that the first machine age, often called the first industrial revolution, was really about overcoming the limitations of our muscle power via the steam engine and the internal combustion engine and a bunch of other developments. Eric and I think that what's going on now is a parallel explosion in our ability to amplify our mental power and overcome its limitations.
And does this mean, Andrew, that Spike Jonze's movie about her is going to come into reality too? We're not just going to be hearing voices of Siri? We're going to be getting something a lot stronger than that?
You know, I like that movie a lot.
I didn't address a question to him here. I'm trying to bring him into the conversation.
I'm sorry, you called him Andrew.
Oh. I mean, Eric.
That technology is still science fiction, but as we described in the book, a lot of the technologies that were science fiction just a few years ago are becoming a reality now. The first wave really focused more on routine cognitive tasks, kind of like automating tax preparation. But we're seeing now machines that you can talk to and they understand your speech and they carry out your instructions like Siri does. Machines that can drive cars on their own, that can solve problems. And that's affecting a much broader set of jobs than were affected in the previous 10 years.
Yeah, I'm sorry about the name switch there.
Technology would not make that mistake.
No, that's right. So there you go. In fact, You know, I was struck by actually, I think, Eric, it was a piece that you did where you were writing about trying to beat the Grandmaster with a computer and it couldn't be done. But here again, we get into kind of where you're moving with a lot of this.
Well, there was an interesting way that the Grandmaster did come up with. Dutch Grandmaster Jan Donner, when asked what strategy he would use against a computer, he said, "I would bring a hammer."
But there was also the work with the computer and the other Grandmaster. That's the way. I mean, that's, again, the trajectory you'd like to see here is cooperation between man and machine,
right,
or woman and machine.
A more productive approach is exactly what Garry Kasparov described when he, after he was beat by Deep Blue, the IBM supercomputer in the game of chess, he started a new kind of chess called freestyle chess, where, you know, with traditional chess, it's cheating if you let a computer help you, or for that matter, if a human helps the computer when the computers play against each other. But he said, no, let's just get rid of those rules. Let's have teams of humans and computers play against each other and see what happens. And the remarkable thing is that the winner of that contest was not a supercomputer, was not a grandmaster. It wasn't even a team with a supercomputer or a grandmaster. It was a team of good but not great chess players, powerful but not over-the-top computers working together. And that the lesson that came from that was that a team working together with the right division of labor can beat the best human or the best supercomputer. And hopefully there's a lesson there for more broadly how we can use technology to not race against machines but race with machines.
Well, let's talk about the race that's on. I mean, and just in terms of what you envision and what is pretty much down the pike here in terms of what's up ahead in this race with the machines. I mean, we're talking – there's been a lot of talk about robotics for years now, and it hasn't advanced quite along the fast trajectory that many people assumed it would. The same for MOOCs, which you write about, you know, massive free online courses. Everybody thought they'd be taking over the world of education, and it hasn't quite happened that way. So what kind of timeline are we talking about here, particularly with things like robotics and MOOCs?
Well, it's fine. I think people often have this these two reactions to things that are improving exponentially. At first, they're disappointed by how things aren't happening fast enough, and then suddenly they get caught off guard. Take self-driving cars. It was just 10 years ago I was teaching a class, and we were having a conversation a little bit like we're having right now with my students about what machines could do well and what computers can do well. And I gave the example of driving a car as something the machines just can't do. There's too much unstructured information, all that data coming in, sensory information. There's no set algorithm about how you drive a car. But just 2 years ago, Andy and I were riding down Route 101 in a driverless car, a car with no driver. So I was wrong. I was caught off guard.
A little afraid at first, too, weren't you?
Well, I was, exactly. I went through, you could say, there were sort of three phases that Andy and I went through. At first, we were scared, and who wouldn't be sitting in a car with no driver, especially on Route 101. True to form, the traffic here, I have to say, sometimes is a little uneven, just like it is in Boston. The car in front of us came to a dead stop right in the middle of the highway. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I was just gripping the seat there, hoping that my driverless car would recognize this and also come to a stop. And sure enough, it came to a nice, smooth, gradual stop. And after a while, I started getting faith that I could trust the car, and that fear, that terror, gave way to, I guess you'd call it exhilaration. Andy and I have to – it's a little embarrassing, but we were waving out the window to people driving by saying, "Hey, guys, look at us. We're in a driverless car." It was kind of fun.
Have you seen that Subaru advertisement? I think it's gone viral with the dogs behind the wheel. There's a Labrador behind a wheel and another one sitting next to them, and puppies in the back and so on. It looks like a family. It is a family of Labradors, but it's driving. I mean, they've got it. It's not just Photoshop. It's there, you know, moving forward.
It was a little bit like that. But you know, that second phase only lasted for about 10 minutes as well. And then the third phase kicked in, which was, you know, we drove all the way from Mountain View up to San Francisco and back again. It took like an hour and a half. And the car was just driving so smoothly and uneventfully, 55 miles per hour. Of course, it follows the law to the letter. It's programmed in to do that. That most of the ride, I think that the main reaction Andy and I had was, I guess you could call it boredom. You know, it was kind of like watching a dishwasher do its work.
It honestly felt like the monorail ride from your gate to the terminal back at the airport. What was interesting to us is we had a couple of Google engineers in the car with us. They spent the entire ride in that third phase of boredom, even when the car in front of us came to a stop and Eric and I were desperately rooting for our car to do its job correctly. The Google engineers in the car could not have been more blasé about the whole thing. They knew how their technology would perform.
But, and I think this may be a foreshadowing of how a lot of us will end up reacting to technology. Most of us are still in the fear and or exhilaration phase, but perhaps as we get more used to the technology and we learn how to work with them effectively, we'll just take them as part of life.
Well, there's some good news in a number of things to be almost celebrative about. One is that goods and services are going to get lower prices, and there'll be more of them, Andy. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the first of the two main economic effects that we talk about in our book. The word we use for it is bounty, which is just exactly as you say. More stuff, more goods and services. And when you phrase it that way, it sounds like we're just talking about, you know, cheap plastic junk and more empty calories, and who wants that? But we're also talking about health and healthcare and entertainment and communication with each other and different forms of leisure. Bounty is the best economic news going on the planet these days. It's happening around the world, and it's enriching our lives in all kinds of ways. It's really important not to underestimate the bounty.
Well, let me go back to robotics for a moment, because I'd like to hear either one of you talk about Baxter. I mean, in terms of services, that's really here already.
Yeah, so robotics is one of these areas where the progress was really underwhelming for a long time, and then suddenly it's become just fantastic. When we look at these examples of digital progress, and they kind of come out of nowhere, we are reminded of the great quote from Hemingway about how a man goes broke. He says it's gradually and then suddenly. So now we're in the sudden part of progress with things like robots. We got to play with Baxter, which is one of the creations of a company called Rethink Robotics, founded by Rodney Brooks, a colleague of ours at MIT, the guy that brought us the Roomba, the vacuum cleaning robot. His latest one is a factory robot called Baxter. Baxter is a big red humanoid robot. He costs around $20,000. So this is not breaking the bank budget for most manufacturing companies. And the way he works is you take him out of his crate, you plug him into the normal electrical outlet in a wall, you grab his arms, and you guide them through the task that you want Baxter to do. In other words, no programming required at all. And after you've done that for maybe on the order of a half hour to an hour, Baxter goes, okay, I got this. And then he can get a day's work done for you, standing right next to human beings, because Baxter is also aware enough that he's not going to slam his elbow into anybody and hurt them.
And no minimum wage is necessary if you want to hire Baxter from some robotic outlet. What's the cost per hour of getting Baxter to work with?
We've heard Rod estimate that Baxter probably works for about $4 an hour right now. That's a number that's going to go down over time.
Yeah. And Eric, let's talk with you about what to do to adapt to all this, to prepare for these dramatic changes ahead. I mean, I know you're talking about maybe lower taxes on human labor to make it cheaper relative to digital labor, but also you talk about new technologies, you talk about new business models. I mean, there's a whole range of things that you get into here.
Right. We devote three chapters of the book to a set of recommendations for individuals and policymakers, because we think there's a lot that we can and should be doing to adapt to these titanic changes that are already happening and that will accelerate in the next 10 years. And one set of them has to do with reinventing education. You know, in the first machine age, when technology automated a lot of agricultural work, up to somewhere around 90% of Americans worked on farms. Now it's 2%. Those people didn't simply become unemployed, but instead they shifted to new jobs, new occupations, new industries. And part of the way they did that was through what's been called America's best idea, mass compulsory education. We think we need to reinvent education today. It's not simply a matter of doubling down on the old idea of mass education, but it's changing it to impart a new kinds of set of skills. The technology of the second machine age is particularly good at handling routine information processing tasks, following instructions. So the old teaching method of having people sit in rows and follow instructions is probably not going to be the key set of skills for the 21st century. We need to invent education that's focused more on creativity and interpersonal relations. And some of the new technologies, like the MOOCs, actually I think can help in boosting the effectiveness of education going forward.
So education becomes the main way to move forward here, re-educating?
It's one of them. You know, it's been said that the kind of inequality that you often see in society is a result of a race between technology and education. And for most of the 19th and 20th century, America invested heavily, and we stayed ahead in that race. And
this would seem like it would mean much more unequal distribution of wealth, I mean, on the face of it.
Well, if...
Yeah, just finish. You're absolutely right. The second machine age for the past 10 years has led to a lot more unequal distribution of wealth. We are at record levels of total wealth in the United States, $77 trillion, but the majority of that gain has gone to less than 1% of the people. So
the 1% that Tom Perkins feels is going to be assailed by the 99%. Yeah.
And this brings up a really fundamental point. The reason we wrote three chapters of recommendations in our book is they're not about how to make the bounty even bigger. The technologists are doing an amazing job.
Or they're not just about that.
Not about growing the overall economic pie via technology. That's happening. What we're worried about is the second main economic effect of all this progress that we're seeing, which Eric and I label spread. In other words, this bigger and bigger divergence in outcomes and things that we care a lot about, like income and wealth and opportunity and mobility. Most of these things are heading in a direction that we don't like instead of one that we do like. We spend a lot of time in the book on what we can do to keep the bounty going while minimizing the spread.
What do you factor in the way of population, which is moving exponentially all the time, or so it would seem, and resources, and how do those figure into the whole calculus about figuring out what the next machine age is going to bring? I mean, you also got global warming to contend with.
Yeah, and we can't tackle all challenges in one.
No, understood, but that's have to be part of the equation.
And what's interesting is that the U.S. economy now is creating jobs every month. You bring up population. The problem is that on a good month, it kind of keeps up with population growth or gets a little bit ahead. In other words, it's not reducing the overall percentage of people who don't have work because we have a large and growing population. So what we really believe we need to do is create an environment that is as conducive as possible to job growth, and that comes from having an environment that's as conducive as possible to business growth and economic growth.
But we also think that technology can help with a lot of these other problems, healthcare and the environment. I mean, to take energy usage, we've passed peak driving as more people are using technology to get a lot of work done. And you've heard of Moore's Law, the increased computational power per chip, but there's possibly an even more important law, which is Coomey's law, which is that the amount of energy per computation is dropping even faster. So these technologies actually could help us simultaneously create more wealth while also having less of an environmental impact.
And you even hit at the idea of creating income for most, if not all, Americans. Establishing some kind of basic income.
Our recommendations in the farther out chapter, we've got a close in chapter. What can we do in the next, couple, 3 years? In the farther out chapter, we take a look at what might work as technology continues to race ahead. And one of the things that we dug up while we were researching that was some of the perverse effects of tax policy as it stands now in the States. The U.S. federal government gets about 80% of its tax revenue via taxes on income and labor, payroll taxes. Now, the oldest insight from economics is tax the stuff you want to see less of and subsidize the stuff you want to see more of. If we're so concerned about labor and work, we're really ignoring that advice. So one of our farther out recommendations is, why don't we turn the tax on labor into a subsidy on labor? We've got a tiny one of those right now called the Earned Income Tax Credit. Let's blow it up. Let's make it bigger so that you get more than a dollar's worth of reward for every dollar you work.
We're talking, if you've just joined us, with Andrew McAfee and Eric Brynjolfsson. They are co-authors of a book called The Second Machine Age, and they both are at MIT. Andrew McAfee is principal research scientist at the Center for Digital Business at the MIT School of Management, and Eric Brynjolfsson is professor at MIT Sloan School of Management, and he directs the MIT Center for Digital Business. They're co-authors, as I said, of The Second Machine Age. We're talking about The Second Machine Age. It may be already here, and let's talk about what kind of jobs are going to be lost here and maybe what kind of jobs could be created.
Well, the data say that the routine information processing jobs have been especially hard hit. Take tax preparation, for instance. There's a fairly straightforward set of steps that require to prepare your taxes, and many of us, most of us, in fact, use programs like TurboTax to do those taxes because you can codify those steps, reduce them to an algorithm, digitize that, then replicate it. Make one copy, make 100 copies, make 100 million copies, and those can sell for $39. In that process, you create a lot of efficiency. You create consumer benefit. The people who create that software become very wealthy, even billionaires. But think of the people who used to do that job, say tax preparers at places like H&R Block. We have a lot fewer of those than we used to, not because taxes are easier, but because technology is able to do the job more efficiently. That's a microcosm of what's happening in a lot of other industries. whether it's travel agents or secretaries or bookkeepers. And increasingly, my colleague...
That's kind of the canary in your digital coal mine.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my colleague David Otter at MIT and others have looked at the skill content of jobs, and they've found that there's a component of routine information processing in most jobs, and the more routine information processing there was in the job, the more rapidly it declined. But one of the reasons that Andy and I wrote this book is we see the technology as getting more and more capabilities to not just do routine information processing and routine physical work, but increasingly unstructured problem solving, the kind of work that, say, Watson does to play the game of Jeopardy, and also now increasingly to answer questions on call centers or to do medical diagnosis or provide investment advice. Language, not just understanding it, you can speak to your phone now and it understands what you're saying and carries out instructions, but it can grade essays. And if it can grade essays, could it write them? Well, in fact, yes. We have software that can write sports stories, simple business stories. So the categories that used to be uniquely human are shrinking rapidly compared to those that machines can do.
And the text preparation example is not that surprising, right? Texts are complicated, but they're about knowing what the instructions are and following them accurately. You know, or you probably imagine that a software program would get pretty good at that. It's a classic example of routine information processing. Diagnosing what's wrong with the sick patient. Most of us probably wouldn't think of that as a routine information processing task, but Watson, after it won on Jeopardy, basically has been going to med school and learning how to apply its astonishing pattern matching abilities to the work of medical diagnosis.
So and tax preparers, doctors become more obsolete.
We see lawyers.
English professors, yeah. Or composition teachers. I mean, all of these. How do you compensate for all that?
Well, there are still
There
are still a bunch of things that we haven't seen technology be very good at all. Anything having to do with ideation, creativity, innovation. I still haven't seen an innovative computer. We still clearly hold the high ground with interpersonal communication, even though technology is getting better at it. So if you're a good manager of other people or a good salesperson to other people, you'll probably have a job for some time to come.
This could be big hemorrhaging of jobs, though. I mean, I think you're being idealistic, and I applaud you for that. But, you know, where these other jobs are going to come from?
The thing to bear in mind, and we are genuinely concerned, as you are, and I think everyone should be, but we also have to calibrate. Remember, technology has always been destroying jobs. It's always been creating jobs. This time, the scale and scope seems to be broader, more pervasive, more rapid. But we're hopeful that if we draw attention to these issues, that we will be able to generate the new jobs as the old ones get automated away.
And Michael, you ask the critical question, which is where are the new jobs going to come from? Anyone who tells you they have the complete answer to that question is either lying to you or lying to themselves. And Eric and I are pretty adamant. The answer to that critical question is not going to come from Washington alone. It's not going to come from a couple alleged smart guys in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's going to come from this vast, very decentralized system of economic activity and job creation that we call the economy and that we call entrepreneurship, which is why a lot of our recommendations are focused on creating the right environment to let innovation and entrepreneurship happen, not because some entrepreneurs get rich and we just love rich people, but because what entrepreneurs do is create jobs for other people, which is critically important now.
Well, we haven't even talked about or broached artificial intelligence and its role in all this, but there's a lot to talk about here. And in fact, you, our listeners, may want to join the conversation. I want to invite you to do that now. Our toll-free number is available to you, so please feel free to talk with us about the second machine age. It's coming if it's not already here, and the concerns as well as perhaps the excitement that's being generated about it. Our toll-free number is available, so feel free to join the program. 866-733-6786 excuse me, is a number to call. We welcome your calls. Again, that's 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQEDForum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Well, we're talking about the second machine age with a couple of people who have written a book about the second machine age. Andrew McAfee is a principal research scientist with the Center for Digital Business at MIT School of Management. That's the Sloan School of Management. And Eric Brynjolfsson is professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management. He directs the MIT Center for Digital Business. They co-authored a book called The Second Machine Age, and they'll be speaking tonight at the Hillside Club in Berkeley at 7:30 p.m. and tomorrow at the Commonwealth Club at 6 p.m. with Andrew Leonard of Salon, someone whose work I have also admired, as I have the work of these two gentlemen. And we're just doing a little riff off the air. It's too good not to do here on air. I was saying, you know, you replace me with a talk show host, and right away they went into shtick, right?
Yeah.
Right. We were just saying, yeah, it won't just be you. I think they both sides of the interview will be replaced by robots at some point.
And then Eric's joke was, if when the host asked, why did you write the book, the answer is, well, you already know.
Yeah.
You know,
there you go.
Since we share a big, big hive mind now.
Let me
a few years away from that, just to be clear.
Let's hope so.
I'm glad you said that. No. Some listener responses. We'll go to your calls in just a minute. Corey writes, with computers becoming more and more intelligently interactive and with IBM's Big Blue already a reality, when does Surrey have the capabilities of a Big Blue?
I think that's going to be a really interesting milestone, and it's already happening when Siri marries Big Blue and Watson, and they it won't be the hive mind, but it'll be merging of these capabilities. We'll be able to talk to our machines and in natural language and have them carry out our instructions, and that's something that I see happening just in the next few years.
You say so, natural language. Does that include dialects and accents and vernacular?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, there was a great example. Rick Rashid gave a talk. He was from Microsoft, gave a talk over in China last year, and it was simultaneously translated not by a human translator but by a machine.
Let me read some comments online from Bill, who writes, how are we not or why are we not building a better society with technology? Google wants to bring us driverless cars. Meanwhile, homelessness increases, middle class living disappears, and the rich get richer. What's the point? Which is more important, driverless cars to eliminate death or injury but ignore middle class living and homelessness? Come on, Google. Talk about the economic consequences. Does anyone see where this is all headed?
Well, let's talk about some of those economic consequences. Warren Buffett, for example, can't buy any more Wikipedia than we can. That is a completely evenly distributed technology, very important one that you don't need a dime for. I think the economic consequences for a blind person of a driverless car would be profound and hugely beneficial. So I really want to push back on this idea that we are not creating a better society with this technological progress. We are creating a more bounteous one. The whole reason Eric and I wrote the book, though, is to call attention not just to this great news, we're not utopians, but to call attention to the challenges that your commenter is describing so well, and to try to think of remedies for them. But we want to be super clear. Technological progress is good news and is creating a better world for us.
Ultimately, let me just say, it's not either or. It's not the driverless car or helping the middle class. We see the technology as being the best hope for helping people in a lot of different dimensions. There's an old joke that economists consider technology the only free lunch that we have, and we certainly agree with that.
Economists walk around going, there's no such thing as a free lunch. They're adamant about it, and then they go, okay, there's one.
Well, one more online comment I want to read here before we get to your phone calls, and you can join us online at kqed.org/forum, or you can call us at 866-733-6786. This is Joe, who writes, to put self-driving cars into the same category as 3D printing seems clueless. The former is a toy technology for automotive hipster man-boys with too much cash, narcissism, and concomitant need for attention. They produce dangerous vehicles that will inevitably harm pedestrians, bicyclists, and anything else that gets in the way of these not-so-smart cars. All software has bugs. In this case, bugs at risk to maim and kill. 3D printing, on the other hand, doesn't destroy, but rather it constructs and liberates. It solves the problems of small-scale, one-off production, thereby freeing people from the unresponsive corporate supply chain and expressive prototype-making shops. 3D printing has even been used to build homes, although that process is potentially destructive as it risks to destroy vitally needed jobs.
Well, I think the caller's half right, and having just come from the Fab Lab, where my colleague, my MIT Media Lab friend Neil Gershenfeld showed off the latest 3D printing, I'm even more amazed than I was before about it. But on driverless cars, I have to say that ultimately is going to be at least a $1 trillion impact, and it will be safer. They're already on the order of 40,000 deaths, highway deaths from human drivers, and I'm confident that when we have more self-driving cars, that number is going to go back down by 90%, maybe 99%, but probably not quite 100%. So ultimately, that's going to have an enormous impact on transportation. But the reason we talk about it is not just for the sake of driverless cars themselves, but because that's an example of how a highly unstructured task can now be solved by machines, and that opens up the door for a whole broader set of tasks.
Well, you mentioned the Media Lab. You know, I can remember discussions we've had on air about the Media Lab, going back to when Stuart Brand was writing about the Media Lab when he was doing the Whole Earth Catalog. And There's some fascinating stuff just coming out of there almost every day, it seems.
You know, it's to the point now where I think Eric and I are no longer surprised when we pick up the paper in the morning or open up our browser and read about some crazy sci-fi advance, you know, Gossamer drones or 3D printing organs. We go, oh yeah, you know.
We're going to have drones like Jeff Bezos thinks, you know, delivering things.
Well, he's maybe a little ahead of himself on that, on the timing of that. But those kinds of technologies will be coming along. And part of the reason we wrote this book is because we spend a lot of time not just at the media lab, but at CCL, the Computer Science and AI Lab, and here in Silicon Valley. And we are just astounded by the technologies that people are putting in place. And if you hang just with them, you end up, you almost automatically become kind of a techno-optimist or even techno-utopian. But we also hang around with another group of people, the economists. And there's a reason they're called the dismal science.
The dark science.
The dark, exactly. So I was just at the American Economic Association meeting in Philadelphia, and I was on a panel with three other economists. And they all really hammered on some of these more dismal statistics that we heard a little bit about, stagnating median income, falling employment. And those are very true as well. And part of the reason we wrote this book was to reconcile these two perspectives. And what we concluded was that it's totally possible for innovation to be faster than it ever has been, for the pie to be bigger than it ever has been. But the dirty secret is that there's no economic law that says that while technology grows the pie, that everyone's going to benefit evenly.
And again, Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee's book is called The Second Machine Age. I want to go to your calls, and let me do that, and we'll begin with Denise. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call, and thank you so much for the service that you do. My issue with technology is that it is wonderful. It has made my job as a professional nurse much easier in some ways as a tool only. But I think we cover dangerous ground when you begin eliminating the human process that is involved in direct human services. We're not just bodies. We are a body. We are emotional, we are intellectual, and we are spiritual beings. When you eliminate that avenue, and it's already been happening, for the direct eye-to-eye contact to take a look at what the person has to say, we look at, as healthcare professionals, we look at, is the behavior consistent with what the person is saying? So we're eliminating an entire component of human behavior and human problems that are probably being 100,000-fold exponentially created by eliminating that very direct human service. And we don't value it at the ATM. We don't value it at the gas pump. We don't value it at the grocery store anymore.
Yeah, we're losing a lot of human connectedness and as the world becomes more virtual. And the fact of the matter is that there's something about human intuition that plays a central role, or ought to, in the affairs of men and women and human affairs. The fact of the matter is there's real concern about this. There was when we started out with the Internet revolution.
Right.
I remember talking about it with Howard Rheingold way back when.
Exactly. And what we don't want to do and we're not recommending is that we get humanity out of the loop wherever and whenever possible. It's a terrible idea. Our caller was a nurse. What they are able to do is astonishing. They're able to get people to elicit their symptoms, observe for themselves, put people at ease, get them to comply with their medication. It's a wonderful bundle of stuff.
I want Clara Barton or Florence Nightingale. I don't want Siri.
And it's a very human bundle of stuff. Teachers as well, trying to get a group of school kids to sit anywhere near still and pay attention and learn. These are astonishing talents. They're very human talents, and we don't want to see them wiped out by technology either.
And interestingly, machines just aren't very good at that bundle.
Right.
The interpersonal relations, the interpersonal skills, the emotional connection, even just the gentle caress, that's something that you can't get from a machine that they're not good at. And interestingly, in many ways, as technology automates a lot of the more routine parts, it's putting a lot of the humanity back into jobs, at least if it's done right.
Let me get another caller, and that's you, Miles. Welcome. You're on the air.
Good morning, guys. I just had a quick question. Having worked in the food industry before, I noticed that, my question is, our food industry is beginning to implement technology into the things that they do, for instance, taking orders or cooking meals that can only be done a certain way. Is this something that we're starting to see?
Absolutely. when I fly the shuttle back from New York to Boston, there's a place that I stop off to get a glass of wine, and I order it via an iPad, and I swipe my credit card to pay for it. Now, a person still brings me that glass of wine, but every other step has been handled by technology. And we use Burger Flipper as a shorthand for the kind of, you know, fairly low-wage, low-skill, lousy job that's not about to be automated away. Well, recently they rolled out a machine that takes raw materials like heads of lettuce and ground meat in the front end and can turn out about 360 burgers, totally customized burgers, an hour out the back end. So again, it's just another data point, this broad, fast, deep encroachment that we're seeing of technology into stuff that used to be people.
Thank you, Miles, for the question. I want to get to more of your calls, and let's go to Dave next. Dave, thanks for waiting. You're on with us.
Yeah, hi. I've run a bunch of cloud computing events around the world under the title of Cloud Camp. In over 100 cities, we've had like 40,000 people, and what I've noticed is that there's just massive amounts of innovation coming all over the place, thousands of ideas every day, and it seems like most of these ideas are eliminating friction in tasks that our middle class typically has done. I think this is in agreement with the callers here. What I'm wondering about is, it seems like human intelligence is kind of spread out of like a bell curve, and yet technology is kind of like an inverted bell curve, and though therefore the people who are getting going to the end of the curve and the high end are able to take advantage of the technology in a really extreme way, whereas anybody who's in the middle of the bell curve is losing the ability to take advantage of that technology. And so the masses, I don't think, are able to keep up, and I think that's going to turn us into a society that can't really benefit from these wonderful technologies that we're now getting. And I'd like your comments on that.
Yeah.
Your intuition is borne out by the data. And in the book, we describe exactly what you're talking about. One of my colleagues at MIT, David Otter, has done some research about the increased hollowing out or polarization of the labor market. And it really started with the automation of a lot of routine information processing jobs, those middle-skill jobs, whether it's you know, tax preparer, travel agent, bookkeeper, that you talk about and that tend to be among the first to be automated. And a related phenomena is the rise of more winner-take-all markets. The income distribution is looking more, instead of like a bell curve, but like a power law, where there's sort of a hockey stick with some extreme payoffs to a very small group of people. After all, if you take a process and you digitize it, and there are, a software program, whether it's for tax preparation or whatever, most people don't want to buy the 100th best or even the 10th best program. They just want to buy the best one or maybe one or two top ones that are customized to their needs. That kind of winner-take-all markets leads to much more extreme income distribution. And those people who are skilled, creative, or lucky enough to have one of those products at the extreme are going to do very well. But it's going to lead to a very much more skewed income distribution than what we've had in the past.
Dave, we thank you for your call. And let me get a caller on from Oakland. Peter, that's you. Welcome.
Thank you very much for taking my call. You know, when we went through the Industrial Revolution, labor argued successfully that we should have a 40-hour work week, and with the additional advances that we're getting with robotics and technology, I think it's time to review that question and whether we should shorten our work week further in addition to higher labor minimum wage to adjust to this new reality in an equitable and fair way. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the call.
Yeah, Peter's suggestion is a really intriguing one. This idea of if you can satisfy your material needs with fewer hours of work because stuff is getting so much cheaper, maybe we should be working fewer hours and sharing a job. We're seeing this take off in some countries, primarily Northern European ones. I think it's a really encouraging trend. And one of the reasons Eric and I want to reduce the tax burden on labor is that right now each incremental employee is really expensive above and beyond their salary to an employer. Let's get rid of those frictions, and then we'll see more innovation around things like job sharing.
And we've got an anesthesiologist on next. Mo, hi, you're on.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for taking my call. I went to medical school for 4 years. I trained 7 years to be a cardiac anesthesiologist. My specialty is anesthesia for heart surgery. And I think about 80% of my job is simply pattern recognition and responding to my monitors beeping at me. And I can clearly see a situation where the monitors, instead of informing a human being of a problem, can simply treat the problem themselves. And, you know, I don't think that's that far away. Depth of anesthesia can be monitored, heart rate, blood pressure, all these things can be controlled and probably controlled with algorithms pretty well.
Yeah, Mo's admission is a really admirably frank one. He says about 80% of what he does looks straightforward to automate. That might mean that in the near future, we can have one anesthesiologist doing the work of five currently. And it really doesn't matter how many years of medical school someone like Mo went through or the amount of money and time they spent training for it. The technology doesn't care about that.
Well, Mo, you must have mixed feelings about this, don't you?
Well, I do. You know, on the one hand, I hate to see the loss of income and the potential for instability in my own life. But on the other hand, you know, healthcare costs way too much, and we all know that.
Wow.
And you know, there has to be some technological solutions as part of the overall solution for reducing our costs.
Wow. Hear, hear, Mo.
Yeah, thank you, Mo. And let me go to some emails. Alan writes, what real value is there, I want to know, for my refrigerator and vacuum cleaner to be connected to the Internet of Things? It seems creepy. Jeff writes, all of this advance is great, but I think it's unconscionable that it should be allowed to be owned by corporations, primarily and especially Google, for whom it will become their trade secret market advantage. You wouldn't let a company own a cruise missile, and no company should be able to own AI, that is artificial intelligence. Instead of concentrating all this technology inside Google by buying all the AI companies in the world, Google should be directly supporting public research and development efforts. Don't be evil, my eye. Ernst writes, I've spent some time working on systems that might be seen as related to artificial intelligence. Computers seem to continue to be pretty bad at identifying things based on their Platonic ideal. That is, if I show a computer a table and say, this is a table, it doesn't do well at identifying other tables. How is progress on that problem going?
To take the last one first, that has been one of the toughest problems in artificial intelligence. And there is some progress being made at, yes, Google of all places, where machine deep learning techniques have now been able to identify cats, chairs, tables in ways that couldn't be done before. But it is an example of what's sometimes called Moravec's paradox, which is that sometimes it's easier to automate really high-skilled structured jobs like, say, an anesthesiologist or perhaps MIT professor, or at least parts of our jobs, than it is the simple tasks that any 2 or 3 year old can do, like recognizing a chair or a table or a cat. But that's changing over time with these deep learning algorithms. As to what the use of all these technologies will be, well, I think we need to be a little careful before we say that's going to be useful, that's not going to be useful. When people first told me about Wikipedia, I thought that was an example of something that would never work, that just the economic model wasn't there, and of course it's turned out to be a huge success. In our economic system, it's not the job of MIT professors or policymakers or others to decide which products are going to be useful or which ones aren't. It's the job of consumers and ultimately entrepreneurs to come up with those ideas. We essentially crowdsource that question, and many ideas that we thought were going to be foolish end up being really valuable, and others, for that matter, that we thought were going to have a big payoff end up not being.
Wikipedia is an interesting example, though,
sure,
because I was with you. I mean, I felt, you know, what kind of model is this going to be? But it also has some real flaws to it. I mean, you know, there are people who are concerned about political bias of Wikipedia. There are people concerned about inaccurate data in Wikipedia.
Then they can go on and edit it
like everybody else can.
Yeah, exactly. And my point isn't necessarily to pick on Wikipedia as the greatest thing since sliced bread or terrible. My broader point is that it's often very difficult to predict exactly what the uses of some of these technologies are going to be. When we crowdsource the problem, then some entrepreneurs that have ideas that we thought weren't going to work turn out to be quite successful, and others don't.
Our last commenter brings up a really interesting development, which is, historically, it's been super hard to teach a computer what a table looks like. And our colleagues have been wrestling with that for a long time. The innovation that's taken place is to use this new category of machine learning stuff that Eric refers to.
This goes back to Bishop Berkeley, you know.
it's got a long heritage, but it's really gaining steam now, because what we do is we show it, I'm going to make up the numbers, 10,000 images where we've already identified the table. And we say, okay, you see that? You know where the table is there? And the computer says, yeah. And then we say, here are a million images over here that may or may not have a table in them. How many of them can you find? And the computers are getting really good at saying, okay, I've found the tables and getting it right.
To give you a real concrete example of that, Google recently decided that they wanted to map all the street numbers in France. And so you might think, well, how many people did they hire to go and record that and to look at the pictures? It turns out zero. What they did was they fed all the images from Google Street View into their deep learning algorithm. And within 1 hour, they had basically mapped the country.
Since you mentioned Google, I wanted to read an online comment from one of our listeners, Ernst, who says, Google, being a corporation, has one legal imperative: to make profit for its owners. You can't ask Google or any other corporation to do anything significantly beyond that. Instead, if you want the middle class saved, the poor comforted, the homeless housed, you must change the laws. With mass practical artificial intelligence around the corner, I think American-style capitalism must finally change.
Capitalism is always evolving. What Eric and I really don't want to do is throw any baby out with the bathwater here. The system we have has led to an astonishing amount of material affluence, of improved lives, and of freedom for us. And we're actually big fans of capitalism instead of bomb throwers at it.
But what Andy said also is that it's got to be modified. It's got to be updated. We want to do it in ways that affect the income distribution, that provide broad skills. That the kind of capitalism we had in the 19th century isn't the one that worked for the 20th century, and it's not going to be the one that works for the 21st century.
One more email here from Penelope, who says, how can we avoid the future that Vonnegut outlined half a century ago and play her piano? In it, jobs were made obsolete one by one as they were mechanized, and the humans who held the jobs that were taken over by punch car instructions had the option of joining one of two crummy occupations, the Army or the Department of Reeks and Wrecks, that is, Reconstruction and Reclamation. The managers and engineers whose jobs haven't yet been mechanized represent the elite living in mansions instead of squalor, and we're living this already today with the software Americans pricing out the non-techie populace out of the Bay Area. And I want to remind you are listening to Forum, and we are talking with Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee. This is a fundraising period for this radio station. More information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny.
Well, that book by Kurt Vonnegut was a terrific one, and he laid out a dystopian vision of how the future might unfold. We've also heard utopian visions where the technology provides for most of our wants and needs. Andy and I sometimes talk about a digital Athens, where people are freed from routine labor and able to discuss philosophy, write poetry, attend plays. Of course,
don't forget the sheep in this bucolic.
The sheep off there in the distance. And in ancient Athens, of course, that was because they had human slaves doing all the work for them. So we don't want to have that kind of a future. But robot slaves, I wouldn't mind as much. But ultimately, we don't think either of those futures is inevitable, either right. The dystopian one or the utopian one. We call ourselves mindful optimists because we think that we have to work hard to control the kinds of future, to shape the kind of future that we're going to end up in. And that's going to depend not so much on the technology, but on our own actions, on the actions of our policymakers, on the actions of corporations. And we need to diagnose what the issues are so we can have the right prescriptions.
And a big part of the reason we wrote the book is because we share the concerns of a lot of our commenters here today. As technology is racing ahead, it's pretty clearly leaving people behind and maybe even a lot of people. We need to be mindful of that. We need to put interventions in place.
More of your calls. Mark, thanks for waiting. Join us. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Michael. Good morning. Very interesting conversation. I thought one of your guests reacted fairly defensively and said at the beginning of the show that this technology is going to create a better society, it's going to improve society, and those are two different things. So let's not get these two things confused, even though they can be very much intertwined, especially in this conversation. Making society better for people is done with or without technology and is independent of technology. It may use technology, but new technology does not indicate better society. It's pretty clear. Also, all utopias we have, all predictions of the future are by nature false. So all utopias and all dystopias that we might predict are wrong. However, we've never had a utopia on this planet, as far as we know. It's well documented, and we've had plenty of things that look a lot like dystopia, especially in the last century. So I would like to encourage Google and Microsoft and all the other folks that are working on this and have objections to the way their information they've been collecting is being used by the government and who knows who else to come up with a way, not necessarily using just software, of making sure that, first of all, adopt the most stringent privacy standards that are on the planet, maybe those of the EU for everybody, and then work with us to figure out a way to make sure that they can collect all the data they want as long as no personal information can ever identify that with the person in any way, unless there's legal reasons for that, and just disconnect those things so that they can still get their advertising revenue. They just don't know that that target person happens to be a person named Mark in San Jose.
All right. Well, privacy does play into this picture in a big way. But the response to the caller, especially about can't predict utopia or dystopia?
I think our caller makes a great point that we took some pretty large steps in a dystopian direction over the past century. What's interesting to me is that almost all of those big steps were by societies that started to think of corporations as evil and private property and ownership as evil and tried to engage in mass centralization and efforts toward these, you know, kind of more collectivist utopias. The lesson of history on that stuff is very clear, which is why Eric and I are both ardent capitalists, even though we're concerned about the people being left behind.
Here's a listener who writes, Ray Kurzweil, futurist, who's been on this program, predicts that technological singularity will occur around 2045 when artificial intelligence will have progressed to the point of greater than human intelligence, radically changing civilization, perhaps human nature, i.e. mankind merging with machines, completely imperceptibly, the rise of robo-sapiens. We're into Arnold Schwarzenegger futuristic territory here, but that is Ray Kurzweil pretty well represented there.
Sure. Well, Ray Kurzweil is a good friend of ours. We spent a lot of time talking about some of these issues with him and reading his terrific stuff. Just to be clear, our book is not about the singularity or about that far future. We see the pace of change happening so rapidly that even just understanding what's happening in the next 10 years is more than enough for us to bite off. As the previous caller said, you know, it's very hard to make predictions, especially about the future.
Your book isn't dated already, is it?
No. Some of our examples are a little bit like, oh, yeah, we heard about the self-driving car.
Yeah, exactly. So we think that there are plenty of changes happening in employment, in work, in healthcare in the next 10 years. Yeah. You know, in the next 20, 30 years, I think we'll maybe be able to solve global poverty. That's the realistic possibility. We may be able to provide a level of abundance that we've never seen before. But we don't spend much time in the book at all talking about 2045 and beyond.
You can meet the authors tonight at the Hillside Club in Berkeley at 7:30, and they'll be tomorrow at the Commonwealth Club at 6 p.m. with Andrew Leonard of Salon. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Good to have had you on Forum this hour.
Michael, thanks a lot.
It's been a delight.
And the book, again, is called The Second Machine Age. And I want to get the subtitle right, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. Senior editor, Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.